My brother-in-law said something this last summer. There's people that are smart and there's people that have experience, and wisdom is the combination. You do not have to be smart to be wise, but you do have to have the experiences. And I think where my confidence comes from is the knowledge, is the background.
Connecting the dots with the Renaissance people.
Hello, Renaissance people and folks who would like to cultivate a Renaissance mindset. I'm your host, Renaissance woman Sarah Kobilka, and it's time for another blast from my very own past. Back in episode one, I talked about a pivotal program that I was involved with when I was in high school. It was called Youth in Government, and today's guest was one of my best friends from that program. We haven't talked in quite a long time, so we had some catching up to do. Morgan Anderson's career has taken him across the country and through multiple industries, which I will not tell you ahead of time because, personally, I think there's such great joy in being surprised and pulling back the layers of a story. Here's what I'll tell you, though. In this episode, we talked, of course, about youth in government and why it was so impactful for us. We discussed the Renaissance all-or-nothing mentality and how Morgan has employed it repeatedly in his multifaceted career. Morgan brought up the unifying feature of caring about people and supporting them that he thinks Renaissance people share. And we talked about selling confidence as compared to the many other things Morgan has sold. And I'll share one little tidbit that we discussed after I stopped recording. I am a huge fan of Top Chef, and Morgan was actually once in the running to be on the show. Now, shows like that have their archetypical characters that they cast for. However, they had unfortunately already filled the role of prodigal chef slash kitchen villain for the season that Morgan was going to be on. So the opportunity passed by. And when it could have maybe come around again in the future, he'd already moved on from cooking. Intrigued yet? Here we go.
Okay, we are set. And Morgan, I'm thrilled to have you here. And as I always do, no dancing around things. We're jumping right into it. Let's start with the very first question I ask everyone. And I'm particularly intrigued to hear your answer since you and I haven't chatted in a very, very long time. So I'm just going off a hunch as to what your answer will be, and I'll see if I'm right. So what term aligns best with your own identity? Renaissance person, multi-passionate, generalist, versatilist, Jack Jill, Jay of all trades, boundary spanner, or some other sort of term that encapsulates you in all of your complexity?
You know, there's a lot that applies to that. I would say multi-passionate.
Okay.
Jack of all trades, if you saw my resume, would definitely apply.
That was the one that immediately came to mind for me, but I love that you're also multi-passionate, and that doesn't completely surprise me, given that I know you have had quite the fun and interesting life. So let's kind of rewind things a little bit. I want to explain a little bit just first of how you and I know each other. So we met through something that I've mentioned a couple of times on the podcast before. When we were in high school in Minnesota, we were both part of a program called Youth in Government. It was a statewide program, and it was an opportunity for high school students to do a mock state government, basically. And we also had the additional part, which I was part of, the media, which we think of sometimes, at least in journalism school, we talked about that as being like the fourth branch of the government telling truth to power, which they are not always doing it all the time, but should be ideally. And you and I were both involved with the state steering committee. And one thing that I really loved about what they did with that program is that I work with a lot of people who work in these out-of-school settings and serving youth. And they talk about giving youth power and voice and choice and all these terms they throw about, but they don't always do it. The adults kind of still hold that stranglehold on, well, we're going to make the final decisions about everything. But I think they really did actually let this group of 15 to 18-year-olds run things and make really big decisions. And we were both involved with that leadership role for 2 years. What I'm interested in knowing, I was part of a team, actually not from my high school. It was from Camp Itahapi, a camp run by the YMCA. You were part of your high school's team in Brainerd, right?
Correct.
Okay. How did you find out about youth in government, and what got you interested in being involved with something like that?
Man, we're going back a few years.
Just a few. Testing your memory.
A gentleman that I still hang out with, his older brother was dating my older sister. And actually, now that I think about it, our YMCA youth and government program wasn't through the high school. It was strictly through the YMCA.
It was, okay.
But yeah, a gentleman by the name of Chuck, he's kind of the one who introduced me to it. And I think the first year we were eligible was eighth grade.
Yep.
As pages. And I did it because his younger brother and I were good friends. And there you go. The next 4 or 5 years or history. But yeah, it was a great program. And I think the other thing that connected you and I, especially later in the youth and government program, is I can't attest to this now, but when I graduated high school, I had the maximum amount of allowable television productions credits you could have. So my sophomore, junior, and senior year, we did advanced television productions, independent studies, and, you know, filming and broadcasting all the local high school games and all that stuff. But I want to jump back because I think what you brought up, which I didn't even realize till now, is with youth and government, they really did let the kids steer the ship.
Yeah.
And being a 40 plus year old now, I wouldn't have been able to sleep for that week leading up to and during that program. But yeah, we lived and died by our own decisions. And that was one of the reasons why it was so great and powerful.
I think it was. And for me, I was somebody where I didn't necessarily have a lot of really close friends in my own high school. I had a few friends, but when I got to youth and government, not only did they give me a chance to be a leader, but I got to be around other kids where first they hadn't already put me in a category, which you probably have a similar experience where you go to the same school from kindergarten through senior year and everybody's put into a clique and you can't leave your clique because that's who you are. And so I was like, well, don't label me. I want to just be who I am. And I got around all these people in youth and government and I could make myself who I wanted to be. And it was so cool to be passionate. And it was so cool to dig into the details and have thoughtful, deep discussions on topics. And I just felt really embraced and that I could be more of my multi-passionate self amongst those people in youth and government, because they weren't all people who were just obsessed with government or just obsessed with learning how a TV station work. They were really just a lot of Renaissance kids pulled together in one space.
Open-minded.
Yeah.
That was, to this day, I mean, I still have newspaper clippings over my workbench in my garage from my youth and government days. And having not spoken with you in so long, it's just so natural. And what you're saying is so true in that there were no cliques, because all of a sudden you had students from all over the state of Minnesota, all backgrounds. I mean, you can't get any different than a rural school district in northwest Kitson County, Minnesota, and a student from Metro St. Paul schools.
Yes.
But there just wasn't time to form the cliques because it basically all transpired over a week or whatever. But that's what I loved about it, is the lack of labels, the lack of grouping, is it's just let's all come together and get something accomplished. And it was running that mock government for 4 or 5 days. And that's what I loved about it, is it was pure. And everyone had that same goal and backgrounds, religion, financials, all that stuff. It didn't matter, which was, to this day, that's why it was so awesome.
What always impressed me about you and your group of people, who I don't know if I was the only one who called you all this, but I referred to you as the Brainerd Boys. And what impressed me so much, for people who are not familiar with Minnesota, most of the planning happened in the Minneapolis area. And then the actual event happened in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And so for me, as somebody who lived 20 minutes away from Minneapolis, to drive in for a meeting, or maybe on the opposite side of Minneapolis, it was a 30-minute drive. But it's 30 minutes. Okay, I can do that after school or on a Saturday for the the state steering committee, which met over the course of the entire year leading up to it to plan that. You had to drive, was it 3 hours to get there each way?
Little less than three. I think...
That's a lot of commitment.
Oh, I mean...
For like a high school kid to like give up that much time. Was it surprising, or are you used to it?
No, you know, one thing that my parents taught me was you get out what you put in. Mm. And the last 2 years of youth in government, especially the last year, I had a job as a bartender. So, you know, it gave me an excuse to not have to work. I turned 18 in March of my junior year. Mm. And 2 weeks later, I started bartending. You only had to be 18 to bartend in Minnesota. The biggest problem in high school years for a lot of people is affording a car and gas money, you know? And that wasn't a problem for me. So there was a group of us, John and Carl, I think were the other two main gents. But yeah, we just piled into someone's car and filled it with gas and drove south. And it gave us an excuse to hang out. So, I mean, those are my friends too during those years, still are. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it definitely was a commitment, but I really wish there was a better way for me to express it. And you're doing a heck of a job of that. But just that anything you can do to extend that, you know, 1 week time frame, anything you can do to hang out with those people, be with those people, have an impact, share thoughts and ideas, like anything you can do to extend that week, it was worth it.
That's amazing. And speaking of that senior year, you really accomplished something pretty big. You will forever be my favorite governor of the state of Minnesota, governing simultaneously with Jesse Ventura. So I put you way up there. Like, you were online with him. You got to meet him, right? And talk to him
did.
A few times.
Yep.
He's a bit of a Renaissance man, if you think about it. He operated in a lot of different spheres, a lot of different interests. What was it, do you think, about being a Renaissance person that actually helped you get into that leadership role within youth and government? Do you think that played a part?
Oh, absolutely. I've always stuck up for the little guy, little gal, the quote unquote, you know, to use that click term, not so cool people.
Yep.
Because there's a heck of a lot more what I would consider normal people than affluent people out there.
Yeah.
And I ran my governor campaign for youth and government the same way Jesse Ventura did.
Yeah.
And the way he did it is he ran as an independent, and the Democratic candidate and the Republican candidate would squabble at debates and he would just poke fun at him.
He also said he was going to legalize prostitution and fireworks.
Oh,
you didn't run on that, though, but I'm pretty sure you probably had some fun things in your campaign.
But yeah, he would just crack jokes, and in the middle of a debate, it would become like a 1 minute comedy show.
Yep.
He would just be like, look at these two jokers arguing about something that doesn't matter. He probably did say something like that. And then, oh, and by the way, I'm going to legalize fireworks so we can have fun on the 4th of July, you know, and he just didn't get caught up in the political muck. And that was just kind of my thing is it's just like, why does everyone have to be so serious about this? Let's make sure, what was my slogan? Have fun, get things done. Man, I haven't said that in about 30 years.
It's that live hard, play hard mentality.
Yeah.
I think a lot of Renaissance people and multi-passionates are good at that. They are both good at having fun and playing and being curious and creative. But then when there's stuff that needs to get done, they're also really good at like putting their heads down and getting things done.
Oh, and that describes me to a T. You nailed me there. Because if I get into something, it's all or nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't matter if it's a government program, my work now, my work in the past, my hobbies.
Yeah.
There's no other way to say it. I don't half-ass anything. If I'm going to be training my dog, it is intense. Books will show up from Amazon and treats will be researched and I will morph my own training program from, you know, reading 36 different books. And no, it is. It's bearing down and getting it done, but then playing hard too.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of how I do everything. We talked about before we recorded surfing in San Diego. I went from never having surfed in my life to surfing 5 days a week overnight.
Yeah.
And it was just like, I was terrible, but I was going to figure it out.
You're going to do it. It's going to happen.
I was going to figure it out. So that's pretty much how I dive into everything.
Were you either salutatorian or valedictorian at your high school?
Ah, So this is going to go off on a tangent.
Yes. Woo-hoo!
I know
celebration
you're a fan
song.
Of tangents.
Yes. Tangents are the best.
No. So basically, to be valedictorian at my high school, I don't know what the standards are now, but you had to have above a 4.0 GPA. And that comes from advanced placement classes. And rather than do the AP class route, I took one AP class my junior year of high school, and I slept through the class 3 to 4 days a week because it was spring semester and I was bartending. So I'd get home from work at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., and AP government was one of my first classes of the day or something. But anyway.
Oh, how ironic.
Yeah, I didn't do the AP route. Actually, my senior year, I went post-secondary. Mm. So I went to high school first thing in the morning and did 2 or 3 credit hours of television productions. And then I drove down the road to the local community college and was getting credits stacked up for my associate in arts, my 2-year degree. And part of that was I got really fed up with the high school scene.
Yeah.
And it was very clicky. Yeah. I have no clue who's going to listen to this, but if anyone's ever seen the movie Varsity Blues, the football movie, that's kind of like my hometown back in the day.
Yeah.
And the last year I played football, I was a captain my sophomore year, and I just got fed up with it. I quit. I went from being a captain to not playing. And coincidentally, junior year, that summer before, is when I started a punk band.
Like you do.
So, yeah, you know, that's what you do in high school, and kind of got counterculture and all that. But one thing, my mother recognized this. My mother's a retired teacher, and she finally said, listen, if you are not at least an honor graduate with distinction, I'm done with you.
I disown you. You are not my child.
And she said exactly what she needed to say. So yeah. I can tell you to this day, I could have carried it a lot more. But no, I was nowhere near valedictorian. And to be perfectly honest, if my mother hadn't done that, I would have graduated. But I had bigger and better things on the horizons. I was not a valedictorian, but I did.
You got an A plus in life.
Yeah, I try. Well, that has yet to be determined.
True. Well, tell me, you've mentioned a few of them. We got surfing. What are some other areas of expertise that you have built up over your career that has zigged and zagged and jumped around the country and everything like that?
Oh, man. Culinary. I did go to culinary school. And actually, the day I graduated from that school, I started teaching for them. It was a passion. And when all the other students were drinking beer and being students, I was, you know, nose deep in Escoffier's French literature on how to perfectly cook squab or something ridiculous like that. My biggest idol at that time, if anyone knows, was Alton Brown.
Oh my goodness, yes.
He was actually the commencement speaker at my graduation. He graduated from the same culinary school I did.
He is also a master science communicator, might I add.
Oh.
There is a video that is one of my favorites of all of his, and I'll put it in the show notes. Take a drink, everyone. That's part of my thing, is you take a drink anytime we add something into the show notes, because I'm all about sharing resources. I'm a librarian of ideas, if you will. Good drinking there. I see you've been practicing.
Oh, yes.
So he has one, and there are sock puppets that are literally just socks with mouths. And what it's explaining is something that actually I did with my daughters on Easter. I decided that we'd make some rolls. And so I bought a packet of yeast. And so it's explaining how yeast works. And what happens with yeast is that they release a gas. And when a kid thinks about releasing gas, there's two things they think of: farting and burping. And so these sock puppets are burping to show how the eating and then the releasing of gas is how yeast works, which is something that's involved in multiple food products and something that I actually learned a lot about in a class that you would have loved. I don't know if you had any friends who went to UW-Madison, but there was a class at UW UW Madison in the botany department called Plants and Man. And it was basically botany for non-science majors. And Tim Allen, not Tim the Toolman Taylor, but a different British, large, over-the-top man was our instructor. He said, screw you to anybody who was trying to tell him how to teach a class, and did it his way. And oh my goodness, you would have been in heaven in his class. And he had us learning about yeast and its many uses because we learned about humans' relationship with plants over the course of human evolution. And how did farming start? How did fire start? And what did fire give us in terms of making food? And when we had our lab section for the class, there was just a room that was open up that had a kitchen in it. And so one week, we had the option of baking something. And I went to lab 3 times that week because it was open for like 5 hours every single day. And I was like, I'll make brownies today, and then I'm going to make cookies the next day. And it was such a fun and interesting way to learn about it. And then our big final project, you could do whatever you wanted, including brewing beer, including baking, making a website, whatever. I did a website on the Hohokam tribe and how climate change caused them to collapse. But other people brewed beer, and that was their like final project. And then there was a very interdisciplinary class that appealed to me as a Renaissance person. And he played hard, and we learned so, so much in it. So there's my tangent that we're going off on. But
I think, as a chef,
you would have loved, and just your personality, you would have loved him and what he does. And I'll throw more about him into the show notes. I've mentioned him before on previous episodes.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to check that out. But, you know, there was the culinary thing, started teaching, you know, and speaking of yeast, we got intoxicated by homemade fruit wine when none of us had 2 pennies to pinch together for our years at culinary school.
Just like all the wild animals that take advantage, drunk squirrels, that sort of thing.
Yes. The fermented berries and drunk birds. We've got one of those trees on our property. It can be pretty amusing. But no, I did that for years. I bounced all over the country, Nashville, Tennessee, back to Vermont, where I went to school. And then that's what took me out to San Diego. And the short version is I went from back of house. I mean, you name it, I did it. I got really into ice carving, like chainsaw and 1,000-pound blocks of ice.
You can take the boy out of Minnesota, but you can't take the Minnesota out of the boy.
It's funny because you mentioned that I grew up deer hunting. Yeah. And we had butcher shop. That was one of our classes. It was a second year class. And they brought in this, they call it a saddle of venison. Mm-hmm. And I watched this Chef Jacques. That was Chef Jacques.
Yeah,
he told me, Morgan, you need to put muffler on your mouth. It's the first thing he said to me first day of his class. Yeah, he knew me all too well.
He did.
But I watched in horror John the Flores. He broke down this thing of venison. And he left to have lunch. And my whole block, the whole block of students turned and looked at me and said, okay, how do we do this and not waste it? And I taught my blockmates from having grown up in the Northwoods how to break down a side of venison. So you're absolutely right. But fast forward a few years to chainsaw carving, you know, those fancy charcuterie boards and all that stuff. I was employed by a large casino in San Diego County for some years. And then I kind of shifted. I really lost my passion for food.
Why do you think you lost it?
I mean, we could have a separate podcast just on that. I mean, I'm an open book. I'm a type 1 insulin dependent diabetic, have been for over 40 years. And so I have a different relationship with food than a lot of people do. I'm on an insulin pump now and have a continuous glucose monitoring system. So I know what my blood sugar is at the drop of a hat. And that wasn't always the case. Mm. Through culinary school, through all that, I used to check my blood sometimes a dozen times a day. All my blockmates, you know, they'd come around the corner and I'd be at my workstation with an insulin pen giving myself a shot through my chef whites. So I just had that different relationship. But one of the worst things for me growing up until I basically got on an insulin pump, was having to eat when you aren't hungry or not being able to eat when you are hungry. So if your blood sugar's high and your insulin hasn't kicked in yet, it's not a good idea to eat lunch or whatever. And to give you the super short version, I started feeling like that working in food again. I got into it for the people, the connection with teams, the connection with the customer, nourishing someone. Like, in my mind at that time, what is more noble than giving someone the fuel they need to do whatever it is they want to do?
You're at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, building that foundation.
Yep, that was the reason. And I tell everyone this. I had my passion for food beat out of me, and it was my own fault.
Hmm. And do you think it could come back ever? Or is it
has.
Do you think it's gone? It has.
Not so much like it used to be there. But I have an absolutely amazing time cooking and teaching my wife how to cook.
Yeah.
Like when I was a culinary instructor, I loved being a culinary instructor, but I want to teach the rock stars. I want to teach the PhD students that want to be there. I lasted like 3 months as an instructor, and I went to the campus executive chef and said, this isn't for me. There's one position open that isn't an instructor position. Consider me your only candidate, or consider this my 2-week notice. Because for every one student that gave a hoot, there were 8 that just didn't.
Yeah.
There's nothing worse than pouring your passion and hopes and dreams and aspirations into someone that doesn't care. And I started seeing a lot of that, but I got out of the back of the house and started managing Chipotle Mexican Grill. I was a general manager and a new store opening manager. I helped open, I think, 3 or 4 locations in San Diego County, and I learned a lot there. And that's where I really will probably touch on this later, but this is where I learned to like give a crap about people.
Mm-hmm.
Gordon Ramsay didn't have shit on me. Like, that's my joke when I was a chef. I was a tyrant and I didn't care about anyone but myself. I was the most selfish person. Mm-hmm. And I think that had a lot to do with me losing my passion for food, because it's not about the food, it's about the people. Well, it just took me a couple decades to figure that out.
Do you think you were a tyrant because you actually lacked confidence? Like, sometimes we talk about how like bullies act that way because they're actually not confident and they want to give off that. Or do you think it was something else?
Oh, it was superiority complex. I did not lack confidence. In fact, I was way overconfident. I was the head chef of a kitchen at like the ripe old age of 20. And I mean, that's a career goal for a lot of people. The first tinge that I can trace back to learning it's about the people is a phone call came into my kitchen in Vermont. And 5 minutes later, my whole wait staff was weeping. It was an all-female wait staff, and all of their husbands were members of the Vermont National Guard. And that was the phone call that went out, that their husbands and boyfriends all got deployed to, I don't remember where, if it was Yemen or Afghanistan or wherever we were in the Middle East in the military. And looking back on it, I'm like, this is bigger than just food, you know? And I talk about being a tyrant. Like, one of those servers I made cry the week before just from being an a-hole.
Yeah.
Calling her out and belittling her. And when I got into corporate America with Chipotle, because they were publicly traded at that time, I was surrounded by Spanish first speakers. Mm-hmm. They were all English as a second language. And here I am, you know, a junior high school in Minnesota. Why would I need to take a foreign language? Like, this is just stupid.
Oops.
And in fact, I dropped my Spanish course my junior year.
Oh.
And here I am living in Southern California. And I made a rule to my team. And I said, you only speak English to me and I only speak Spanish to you. And I got fluent. And that was like seeing the other side of it, because I wasn't just around highly motivated culinarians. These are mothers and fathers who are putting their kids through school. So worked for Chipotle for a while and kind of got bored with it, and had an opportunity to work for a family-owned business. They own a chain of pizza restaurants, and I went from mothers and fathers to, I think I had 40-some people on staff, and 90% of them were college students.
Yep.
Like, that was our demographic. A lot of part-time employees, students, things like that. And I butted heads with one of the owners. And I was the hometown restaurant. So we opened the restaurant from the ground up. But that superiority came out and someone didn't like it. And I'll be the first one to own it. I was probably in the wrong.
Yep.
But yeah, I actually passed the law enforcement exam and was almost a cop in Southern California. And I stepped back, and the long and the short of it is it's just like, it's not that I don't like my career. It's that I don't like where I'm at. And Southern California has its own attitude. If any of you have seen Anchorman, the greatest city.
I love Lamp. I have a shirt that says that.
Oh yeah. Locals to San Diego. I mean, they're born and bred thinking that, and it's an interesting community. But I noticed myself taking on some attitudes I didn't really like, so I packed up my Chevy truck and moved to Atlanta and started working still in food, but at an ice cream manufacturer. And it was a connection through one of my biggest mentors in food. He became the executive chef of the school. He's what brought me to San Diego. I worked for him at the casino, and then he moved out of California, started up this ice cream business outside of Atlanta, Georgia. And guess who ended up in Atlanta, Georgia? But that's where I really started learning a lot about myself, coming from what I told my boss in one of our meetings this year. I am recovering from being micromanaged to the nth degree at the culinary school a little bit, but really at Chipotle, at the pizza joint, I couldn't jump without asking. So it was
like the antithesis of what I think is one of the superpowers of Renaissance people, is we can be creative. We have all these experiences like you're talking about that we can draw from. And so we're the ones who can come up with those outside the box ideas, and we can implement them and be like, let's get this shit done. How do you stay in a spot like that? And what finally made you get out of there?
Again, you just hit it right on the head. Is that's why I left those positions without even knowing it.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize it till I was working in Atlanta. High Road Craft Ice Cream. Alton Brown says it's the best ice cream in the country. And I ate a lot of ice cream as a diabetic.
Oof.
And my insulin
I'm lactose intolerant. It doesn't sound fun.
We made sorbet.
Excellent.
Sorbet too.
Good.
But no, there I went from highly structured, having to ask how high to jump, to here's what you need to do, go do it. And I had no clue what I was doing. And that's where the Renaissance person in me was first realized. Because you'd be working on a project for weeks, and on a Monday morning, the CEO looks at me and says, oh, we're not doing that anymore, and you have to do a 180 and start over. And it's just like, oh my gosh, you know? So I went from leading a very structured professional life in culinary and in management, and all of a sudden I'm in this nebulous area where you've got to orchestrate amongst chaos. And man, did I struggle. So I worked for the company for like 6 or 7 months and I quit and got wooed back in, and I went from operations to sales. And I did learn a lot about sales. You get really good at selling something when you're selling something people don't need, like ice cream. And I wasn't for the startup gig. I appreciated the time. I learned a lot, but it's just like, I got to get out of here. So I started managing a retail bicycle shop. That's another huge passion of mine. I used to be a, 4, 5, 6-time state champion BMX bicycle racer. When I was in San Diego and Vermont, I mountain biked. And then in San Diego, I started velodrome racing, track racing, and mountain biking, and cyclocross. That's what I did. I was single, I worked in restaurants, and I either surfed or rode bikes. I needed to get out of food. Toward the end of my time at the ice cream plant, I would get home on Saturdays around 3 p.m. I would do my laundry, take a shower, eat dinner. I was in bed by 6, and I wouldn't wake up until noon on Sunday. I was just so exhausted. I was working 100 hours a week, just grinding. I mean, that's your job as a startup, is to be so disruptive you make money, or to be so disruptive to the industry you get purchased. And it's hard being a small business, and I learned that firsthand. So I started selling bikes. did that for a few years, and you mentioned not liking winter all that much, and here I was. I took a 13-year vacation from Minnesota winters, and actually a youth and government alum got married in the summer of 2014, and I flew home to go to his wedding. This was who I rolled with in high school, and I had largely been out of their lives for 13 years because I was selfish and tramping around the country doing Morgan things, but got to his wedding, and on the plane ride home to Atlanta, I was struggling with getting along with Atlanta. And finally, I admitted, it's not me, it's Atlanta. I got to get home. These are my people. And I fought and looked, and the company I'm with today, it took me a year, but I moved back to Minnesota in July of 2015. And it's funny, we go back to youth and government, like Carl was my running mate. He was my lieutenant governor. Guess whose cabin I just helped finish building out 20 miles up the road from where I live? My buddy Carl's. His wife and I are hunting buddies. His younger brother, who I don't remember because I kind of fell out, but 2 years after Carl and I were the governor ticket, his younger brother, Scott, and shout out to Scotty, he and his running mate were governor, lieutenant governor.
Wow. Brainerd represent. And,
It was great. But yeah, I got back to Minnesota.
And you're in a STEM field now, right?
Oh yeah. Pest control. It really is. And my whole team, there's about 20 of us. Not one of us ever planned on being in pest control. I mean, I've got former sailors, former Marines. A buddy of mine used to be the service manager at a car dealership. Former food plant quality assurance people, former retail workers, bartenders. What did it for me is I love the science behind it. I got to step up on my soapbox really quick to anyone listening to this and let people know. My wife was very concerned when she started dating me and I said I was in pest control. Most people think of the guy with the cigarette hanging out of his mouth on King of the Hill. One of the guys was an exterminator, and that's just a horrible name in and of itself. But the years of going into a building and lighting it up with chemical are long gone. We spend 90% of our time doing preventative work. We're investigators, and where the STEM really leans into it is the greatest accomplishment of my career in terms of eliminating a pest issue was finding a tiny little quarter inch long maggot and tracing that back based on its life cycle, the time it takes from egg to adult, finding out that previously the tenant of this apartment had a dog and their dog food would disappear. So we had mice moving dog food and storing it, and this sat in the wall long enough to hatch what we call a stored product pest. And just being able to put one and two together with the life cycle and all that was it. To this day, I mean, I could spend 2 hours explaining that whole procedure, but I love the science.
So can I go on a tangent with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So have you heard of the science author Mary Roach?
No.
Okay. You're going to love this, but it is totally something that you're going to have to get all of her books, basically. So set aside a few hours of the next couple of weeks. She has a book called Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. And she is a person where she finds a topic and then she just gets interested in it and like goes down every rabbit hole possible. And one of the things that she did was she went to one of the farms where they put bodies out to see the decomposition process. And that informs investigators who are come across a body and they're trying to figure out how long ago it died or how it died. And they're looking at those bugs that... Yep. Actually form and the life cycles of the bugs and everything like that. But that book is a very intriguing book. And it's also going to be in the show notes, everyone. So don't worry.
Perfect.
She also has Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, which was the first book of hers that I read. Gulp, Adventures of the Elementary Canal. Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. And Replaceable You, Adventures in Human Anatomy. So she goes all those places, but it's like that science, but then like how do we apply that to the real world and connect the dots between the science and other places where it could help us to solve some sort of a problem. So I'm curious about you connecting the dots, because you've had all of these different jobs where you've been able to connect the dots. Where do you think you really thrived the most as a Renaissance person and a multi-passionate person in your career? Is there one particular place?
Oh, it's teams and people. Everything has come to that. And I think in listening to some of your other guests, one of the connections and connecting the dots is the care and empathy for others. I'm no longer in the field. I'm no longer chasing bugs for a living. I live in the house that cockroaches built, but now it's about our team and passing the torch on and training and helping them succeed. My only regret in what I do now is I didn't start it sooner. But I think the other connection with Renaissance people and connecting the dots is the quest to better oneself. And I still do that to this day. Like, if I wasn't getting older and my body's fallen apart, I'm a former extreme athlete. I've had so many surgeries and this, that, and the other thing, I'd still be in the field because I love the science and I get to help people. And having a sales background in the field I'm in now, I never had to sell something to someone that didn't need it. The goal there isn't convincing them that, you know, you're just trying to sell them something, is showing them how they need it and why.
You know, that's one of my biggest challenges, because I am, you know, a small business owner.
Yep.
And I am always thinking about who I pay for their services, because I have paid career coaches and people to design my logo and things like that. And all of those things that feel very tangible. And one of the things that I have struggled with that I'm still working on is, how do I sell what I do as Renaissance Woman Consulting? And one of the things that I've really come to after doing some analysis of feedback from people I've worked with who have said, we love working with you, it's great, is that one of the things that I can work with people on and give them is confidence and feeling confident in themselves and their value as a Renaissance person. But it's still hard in my mind to say, how do you put a dollar sign on confidence? Or how do you sell something that's kind of more intangible to people that you know you want? People want to feel confident. They want to feel good. They want to feel fulfilled and that they're like living their expansive lifestyle. What advice would you give to me as a person with a sales background about how do you sell something intangible like confidence?
And it's so situational. I mean, I know how I would do it.
And you're someone who I think is very confident. Like, you have always come across that way to me.
And 80% of communication, or we can argue the percentages, is 80% of communication is nonverbal, right? Mm. So if I'm going to walk into a possible client's office or wherever, their driveway, a barbecue, and I'm going to walk with confidence, straight back, shoulders back, chest out, chin up, and I'm going to make it a point to exude confidence. And I'm going to steer the conversation of, would you do better with confidence? I would just be in your face. You like confidence? You think you'd do better with confidence? That's what I sell.
You think that that message works for someone who is not a white male? Or do you think there's different standards for other people when it comes to, you know, there's confidence, but then women who come across as too confident get labeled as being a bitch or
absolutely,
know, that sort of thing? Like, there's that double standard that comes into play when you're talking about women.
Oh, like I said, that's how I'd
say. That's how you, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, again, it's situational. Am I dealing with an introvert that's looking to start up a web company kind of more behind the scenes? Or am I dealing with a public figure that's running for office and wants some help on their campaign?
So know thy audience, 101 communication.
That's just it. But I think in any situation, you can be direct in saying, one of the things that comes with working with me is helping with confidence, because I can tell you from a sales perspective, there is nothing worse than trying to be sold something from someone that doesn't believe in it or someone that doesn't know. Like, that's selling bicycles. It doesn't matter if it's a $100 bike or a $10,000 bike. You need to know that bike, because that's what develops confidence from the consumer, customer, whatever you want that label to be. So don't be afraid to use those terms.
Part of the reason I created this podcast is because I'm trying to talk to a wide range of Renaissance people. And it's so interesting for me to hear where their confidence comes from or where they are on their Renaissance person journey and their building confidence, because I don't want to just have people who are like, I've made it on the episodes either. I want people who are in that journey. But I think these are the case studies of confidence as a Renaissance person. And it sounds like for you, it took a long time to really say, hey, this multifaceted, well-rounded kid from high school who's traveled around the country and had all these careers and done all this stuff, there's value in me for that diversity of things that I know, not just because I taught this one class or I got this one degree or I worked in this one position. It's the multitudes that makes you magical, not just the limit.
It's the knowledge.
Yeah.
My brother-in-law said something this last summer. There's people that are smart and there's people that have experience, and wisdom is the combination.
Mm.
You do not have to be smart to be wise, but you do have to have the experiences. And I think where my confidence comes from is the knowledge, is the background. My sister's an assistant principal, and I used to do a career day at her school. And I make the same joke, but it's so true. When I'm 90 years old and passing on, I want to remember the smell of my wife's perfume or what red wine pairs with the perfectly grilled hanger steak. Or I don't condone smoking, but what cigar pairs well with what port? No, you know what I'm going to remember? The mating habits of the German cockroach, or the reproductive cycle of a bat bug, or, you know, something along those lines. And one thing I completely forgot to mention in my career, I was a restaurant consultant for some years on the side. So in the pest control field, in the restaurant management field, in the culinary, the cooking field, in sales, everything comes down to time and efficiency. And as a service specialist in pest control, the one thing that taught me was the value of time. We had a salesperson that said, it's the only resource you can't get more of. You can't create more of it. All you can do is lose it, waste it, or use it properly, basically. And I think from someone in your position, you talk about confidence and what you bring as a consultant or whatever someone labels themselves. It's getting your clients somewhere faster and more efficiently than they would on their own. And that's where that wisdom comes in. You've got some experiences. Anyone wants to know anything about me, look at my LinkedIn profile. I mean, that's pretty much everything.
That's what I tell people.
Yeah.
I'm like, but get ready to scroll and scroll and scroll and
yeah,
scroll.
Yeah. You know, but that is something back to the sales side for you. There is no one that has less time than a small business owner
with two small children.
Oh.
Throw them in.
There you go.
Like, extra fun.
I talk about superhumans. I have a coworker. He's my old boss. He still works for Ecolab, but he's in a different role now. He's got three young children. So while in my position, I know for a fact his wife gave birth to one child, possibly two. So on top of being a dad and a very present dad, doing the job I'm now doing, he also got his master's in business administration.
Throw a little more fun in.
But I'm just like, I know how busy I am on the day-to-day. And I don't have children. I've got two dogs. And one of them's a senior citizen, so he's pretty easy. I'm in the trades now. And there's that old joke, there's a machine that's down. And they call in this guy, and he taps on the machine a couple places, and he screws in one screw. This multi-million dollar machine all of a sudden starts working, and he hands him a bill for $1 million. And they say, what is this? You turned one screw. And he's like, well, you're paying a dollar for me to turn one screw. You're paying everything else for me knowing what screw to adjust. You know, that goes both ways in the trades, but there's something to be said about that. And that's what I think you need to extol, is getting from point A to point B fast and efficient, because that's what you bring, is you bring time, you bring experience, and you bring the time savings.
That.
So being able to put a value on that, and people that understand that value are going to snatch that up pretty quick. Because if I could get to where I am today as a 20-something year old, I'd pay a lot.
Wouldn't that have made life easier?
I'd pay a lot of money. A lot.
Absolutely. Well, let's keep playing. Let's have some fun. We're going to play our game that you've heard on previous episodes. And I always give myself the challenge to make it up on the fly. It's an improv game. So we're going to complete the sentence. You know you're a Renaissance person if. And this is going to tie back to something. I think we talked about it before we hit record. So you know you're a Renaissance person if you have at least 25 tabs open on your computer at any given point in time, and I'll add to it. And when the blue screen of death comes on and your computer restarts, you are just like crossing your fingers, hoping and praying that the restore history button actually works. And that happened to me like last weekend.
Amen. You know you're a Renaissance person when you enjoy falling down rabbit holes.
So much fun.
Falling into them and seeing them through. I think that's a definite telltale sign of a true Renaissance person.
Love it. Okay, ready for round two? Let's do it again.
Sure.
You got another one. Okay. You know you're a Renaissance person if your goal in anything you're passionate about in life is to get the metaphorical A+. Not the literal A+. You don't have to be the 4.0 student, but you want the metaphorical A+ on any passion project you take on.
Man.
Did that hit too close to home?
Oh, God, yes.
Jab it in.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you just described the last 30 years of my life. You know you're a Renaissance person when you can't do anything half speed. It's all or nothing. It's pouring it on. The slight tangent to that, it's never just one thing.
Yeah. No, you can't be doing one thing.
Humans are horrible multitaskers, and I am primed to prove that wrong, because there's always multiple things. Always multiple things. And it's not just with work. You mentioned children and work and a marriage, if people so choose, and everything else, the community. There is so much going on out there.
Yeah. I realize I forgot to ask you a question. I want to circle back because I want to hear your answer to it. How do you answer the dreaded question? So what do you do when you meet people in a way that feels like you're not forgetting or putting down your multitudes side?
Wow, we're going to have to talk this one through. What do I do? Man.
You hate that question?
I don't know. Like, off the top of my head, I know how I'd like to answer that. And I'd like to answer that is I make it happen. That's what you're paying me to do. When people ask, what do you do? I get quizzical looks because, like, what are people asking? What do you do for a living? I generally answer that with, I'm an outdoorsman. Like, I don't live to work, you know? But how do I do that and not sound like cocky egomaniac?
Yeah. Or spend 40 minutes explaining to them like your whole zigzag history, which is hard not to do.
Yeah. Like, man, that's a great question. You've heard my take on teams and people. I think the best way to answer that would be is I bring people together. I lead teams. That's what I do personally and professionally. Mm. And you'd almost have to bring it up. What I do is very multifaceted, but I don't want to bore you.
Yeah. Go to my LinkedIn profile. Scroll there.
Exactly. You know, I mean,
I have a QR code on my business card that takes people to my LinkedIn profile. I'm like, I'm Sarah. I'm the Renaissance woman. I'm multifaceted. If you really want to dig down a rabbit hole, here's your personal rabbit hole for the day. Enjoy.
Yeah. enjoy my history. It's quite varied.
Yes. You can find something to connect with me about if you take the time to read this. I promise.
And I think looking back on your question and what we were talking about earlier, you know you're a Renaissance person when, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. You know you're a Renaissance person when people don't believe you when you tell them your age.
Oh, that's a good one. Yes.
I have been told that. They're like, there's no way you've done all this. And it's like, hey, when you move coast to coast across the country 3 times in 10 years, you learn a lot.
Yeah. I bet a lot of like 30 under 30 people and 40 under 40 people probably fit in our category because I was executive director of the Iowa Arboretum when I was 27 years old. And people are like, wait, you've been executive director of an arboretum and a TV meteorologist and this and that. And you're how old?
Yeah.
And there were a couple of us who were in our 20s who were 40 under 40 people.
That hits home. I forgot you were in Iowa. I spent 2 weeks in Iowa this summer helping my counterpart setting up new business and in July. And I really learned what corn humidity is.
Yes, evapotranspiration. The humidity levels in Iowa, Nebraska, and all these corn-heavy places are actually the equivalent of being in a tropical jungle. They're some of the highest humidity levels in the world during that time of year, July, August. And that's, of course, when they do Ragbri, the great bike ride across Iowa. And Nebraska has its bike ride as well. They do it in the middle of corn sweating season. How ironic.
But back to that question, I think there's no simple way to answer what do you do? There is, but it's going to require research for people to understand.
I love it. Well, one of the offerings that I have through my business, actually, that I'm going to be really kickstarting is called Find Your Golden Thread. And it's an opportunity to have me as a thought partner. And you send me a bunch of information about yourself. I scroll through all of your LinkedIn profile or read some bios that you've submitted or your about section on LinkedIn, and I can reflect back to you. Here's what I'm seeing as a golden thread that you can then use and put some of that language together to actually feel a little more confident in answering that question. And the answer is going to be maybe like for me, I'm a Renaissance person. I cross disciplinary boundaries. I help Renaissance people confidently live expansive lives. And if you want to find out more, go to LinkedIn, read more. But I don't have to tell you the whole story, but I can give you that golden thread so that you have something to grab onto to get started going into that weaving web that my life is.
Well, and we talked about bringing confidence. You sell confidence. You weaved that into your mission statement right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone has those core values, mission statements, all that. It's just words until you act on them. And I hope people can hear the passion that I'm hearing from you, right? That exudes confidence. And we're on camera right now. And obviously that isn't part of the podcast.
Yeah.
But in today's day and age, it's even more important to have that vocalization and to be able to hear that, because I have meetings across the country and I have no clue what these people look like.
Yeah.
If people aren't turning on their cameras during a Teams call or Zoom or whatever, you might work with someone for years and not know it. I used to do it as a restaurant consultant. I had partners, I helped open restaurants before video calling that I knew their name and I knew their address and I knew their voice. And I saw a picture of them. But in today's day and age, that interpersonal, like that's what I thrive on. The people side of things, I don't think I'm going to age gracefully because I enjoy the handshakes and I enjoy learning about people and what makes them tick. But we're getting more and more digital. And your teams just aren't who shows up at the office anymore. It's whoever's on the other end of that Cat 5 cable.
That's why the class that I teach at the University of Arizona, when we wrote the initial grant proposal for that class, I said, I'm in New York. I'm teaching a class in the University of Arizona in Tucson. I need to fly once a semester to Tucson so that I can see the students. The students can see me and each other and we can work together in person. And I always try to do that within maybe like the first month, month and a half of school. And the difference between what our team is able to do prior to seeing each other in person versus after that, even though we've been meeting on Zoom, we have a requirement that as much as possible, have your camera on, we're talking back and forth, we're unmuting, all that sort of stuff. But the difference after we've actually met each other as real full-size human beings, not just from the chest to the top of our heads, it's amazing. It is truly powerful. Well, we could go on. This could be like a 3-hour episode quite easily, but we can't because theoretically I should do something and like work and so should you. So we're going to do our rapidish fire questions. We'll see how rapid we could be. Ha ha ha. The first one is, what's one metaphor that you find yourself using frequently? And right now, my metaphor is very much gardening and planting seeds and things starting to sprout. It's spring right now, and I'm literally going to plant some seeds this weekend, but metaphorically, I feel like the last year and a half, I've spent planting seeds, and it's really been exciting to see some of those seeds blossoming.
That spurred something. One of my managers and I, with our team, say a lot is, fishing metaphor, you can't catch whales every day. Oh. You know, it's a lot easier to catch 10 sunfish than it is to catch one muskie. And that relates to sales and service. So fishing for sure.
I use fishing too. Yeah, but I use it a different way. The way that I use it is with regards to my teaching philosophy, whether I am teaching students how to make graphics for meteorologists to explain hydrology issues, or whether I am working with after school educators who want to bring STEM role models into their program. My goal is to teach them how to fish, not to give them a meal. Because if I give them a meal, great, here's this curriculum, it's already done, or here's this thing, it's almost completely done for you. Then next time comes around, all that work that I put into teaching them, it doesn't matter because they can't do it on their own without me holding their hand and helping them through it.
Yeah.
If I can teach them to fish, if I can teach them what questions should I ask or where are the resource bases that I can go to that when this STEM role model that I've had come to my class for 10 years retires or moves so that I can find a replacement. That's me having done something impactful. And I bet with a teacher mom, we both have teacher moms. I think that teaching people to fish maybe came in a way from my teacher mom.
Oh, it definitely. I mean, you're opening up so many caverns that haven't been opened in years, but even in the here and now, you can't train someone to know everything. But in my field, we train them how to get to the answer.
Yes. Yep. That's kind of how librarians think. They don't teach you exactly all of the content in the library. When we were kids, they taught us how to use the Dewey Decimal System and look through cards and stuff like that. And now how to like use a catalog and enter the correct search information into a database to like find the answers. And it's more important to know where to find answers when we have all these technologies that can store the information for us. We don't have to memorize everybody's phone number, but you do have to know how to open up contacts on your phone so you can find that phone number when you need it. We used to know so many phone numbers for anybody who's younger is listening. And I bet you still know some of your like friends' childhood phone numbers. Our brains were wired literally differently than brains are wired today because now it's where do we find the source of the information as opposed to how much information can we put into our heads. Okay, on to the next one. What is one rabbit hole that you have gone down recently? I know you were talking about like you're really proud of the life cycles of a particular insect, but is there another rabbit hole that you've gone down?
Outboard motors. I have, no joke, in the last 2 weeks, at least spent 20 hours of the free time I don't have researching outboard motors. I needed a new motor for a boat of mine. And, you know, it's just like, just buy a motor. And it's like, well, you can't. Like, which one's going to last the longest? How much do I have to pay? What's the maintenance? Like,
that's what my husband does. He is like, I'm going to get a new coffee maker, but he's not just going to get any coffee maker. He's going to do all the research. And he found the most like chemistry nerd coffee making device. And now he's testing all of these different like methods for making coffee. And he's like pulling out the beans that aren't quite cooked enough. And I'm like, is this because you're not doing lab chemistry anymore? And you need to like find a replacement for it in your life? And he admits, yeah, he missed being a chemist.
Was looping in all my friends. And I just call him, be like, Carl, what's a good outboard motor in here? And he's like, that came out of left field. I'm like, hey, I'm on a time crunch here because there's a webinar I need to watch on outboard motors that starts in 12 minutes. So you've got 10. So let's go.
Outboard let's go, buddy. Remember, I'm Morgan. Let's be Morgan. Start now. Okay, last question, then you'll tell people more about how to continue to follow you and your adventures. Is there something more that you can come up with from your background that might surprise people? Because you've given us a lot of good stuff, but I know there's more. more. There's got to be something in there. Did you take ballroom dancing lessons once?
I once stripped down to my underwear to wade across a creek in March in north central Minnesota. Oh, cold. I've never been so cold in my life. And I did it to avoid getting a underage consumption ticket. And the funny thing was, I went through all this. We didn't get tickets. And the four of us that took off running from the police were the only four that didn't drink. We just got so wrapped up in not getting caught. We literally had no reason to run. If it was today, any one of my friends would have brought me to the ER for hypothermia. It was rough. Like, couldn't speak.
Yeah.
And turns out it was all for nothing. That's about as deep as I'll go.
That's wonderful. Wonderful. I love it. What a great way to end. Okay, so you've talked about LinkedIn. We'll certainly link to that in the show notes. Take another drink, folks, if you haven't gotten, you know, hydrated enough or whatever state you're in from the alcohol or caffeine you're consuming. I'd love it if people would actually listen to my show with something stronger. That'd be funny. But if other people want to follow you, are there any other social media platforms or other spaces where they can learn about Morgan?
LinkedIn is really it. I am not a big social media person. I will go on record. If you look up the Critter Getter on YouTube during the pandemic, I was doing some short videos and I didn't realize what any of the other social medias are, but I do have an alter ego known as the Critter Getter. But basically, if you want to learn more, it's LinkedIn, Morgan Anderson.
Perfect. Well, thank you for an absolutely delightful time period. Wonderful to briefly reconnect, and we'll have to meet up again sometime and chat.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much, Morgan. I'll say until next time.
Connecting the dots with the Renaissance people.